U.S. and Canada had much higher levels in general of glyphosate in all their foods than any other country in the world, including Mexico. So he kind of groups U.S. and Canada as a sort of quote-unquote North America, leaving out Mexico. Mexico he puts in with the rest of the world because Mexico has much, much lower contamination levels in everything than U.S. and Canada. So those two countries are basically the big leaders in poisoning the food with glyphosate.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women changing the world as go-getters and entrepreneurs. You know, people kind of like you. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it, that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. I fundamentally believe that when people are well, they can change the world. I work every day to help reduce the risk of chronic disease in my patients. So when I heard my next guest speak recently at a conference, I knew I had to have her on the podcast. She presented me with an inconvenient truth, and that is that the food I was eating and feeding to my family was not only killing us, but the people who were coming to see me for help. I studied environmental medicine and reproductive physiology. I knew there was a pervasive issue with pesticides, and I understood the mechanism with which it affected us. But this was at a whole new level. If you eat food, then hang in there, because this interview, although slightly more technical and dare I say it serious than I am used to presenting, is critical to your survival. Today, I sat down with Dr. Stephanie Seneff. Stephanie is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Laboratory in Massachusetts. Her studies and interests are in a little tiny chemical called glyphosate and sulfur. So when I say we go deep, we go deep. But I promise we're going to keep it relevant to you. The reason I'm breaking from my traditional lighthearted approach is because I need your help. You are fixers, you are innovators, parents, entrepreneurs, bloggers, journalists, and intelligent members of our society. When we know better, we do better. And when we are done today, you will know that glyphosate is something that affects all of us. It's connected to your risk for leaky gut, heart disease, autoimmune disorders, cancers, autism. We talk about all of it. We talk about the mechanism for it, and we are discussing how this seemingly tiny little thing can have its tentacles in all of these pathways in our body. We discuss the foods that are highest in glyphosate, where you can travel to avoid it, and the class of food that you can eat on a daily basis that are going to significantly reduce your exposure. I will say this one more time. When you know better, you do better. This interview is important for all of us. It is a gift to you. Without further ado, Dr. Stephanie Seneff. Dr. Seneff, it is a pleasure to have you on the Entrepology Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
I'm just delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So I recently heard you speak at a conference, and you opened with this quote from British philosopher John Stuart Mill from 1859. And he said, "The fatal tendency of mankind to leave off thinking about a thing when it is no longer doubtful is the cause of half their errors." And while I think we could probably go in a million directions with that quote, I thought it was such a beautiful segue to this topic that I know you are so passionate about, and that is glyphosate. And I know for people listening, they're going, what? Like, we normally hang out in this really big picture realm, and we're talking about this little thing called glyphosate, but it's actually a big deal. Can you talk about what it is?
Yeah, and in fact, I love that quote because it is so true about glyphosate. Glyphosate is something which was, you know, Monsanto, who's the producer of it, convinced the government that it was non-toxic to humans back in the mid-1970s. It's become pervasive. It's in our food, in our water, in our air. It's everywhere. It's in our cotton products. And we believe it's non-toxic. And as a consequence, the governments don't even bother to test for the levels in the food. You know, they don't care. They don't think it's a problem. And when some crisis shows up, some, you know, anencephaly in Washington State, they don't think of glyphosate, even though it's the obvious reason why the anencephaly is there. I mean, it's just incredible to me. It is so clear to me that glyphosate is the most important toxic chemical in our environment. And if we could just do one thing, we should ban glyphosate worldwide, and we would have a huge improvement in health and in the earth, you know, all the species. I mean, it's just incredible how much we would gain by just banning that one molecule.
So where's it coming from? How is it in all of this food and water and our environment?
So glyphosate is the active ingredient in the pervasive herbicide Roundup, and I'm sure people are familiar with, you know, controlling the dandelions in their yard, especially maybe killing the weeds that are growing in their walkways. Very convenient. You go down to the local garden store, you buy some Roundup, you spray it on the cracks in the wall, in the sidewalk, and magically all the things die. You know, it kills all plants except for those few that have been engineered to be resistant, and that's the trick. They discovered back in the late, they introduced in the second half of the 1990s, they introduced a whole bunch of new crops that were engineered to be resistant to Roundup. This is the GMO Roundup Ready crops. And this was a huge breakthrough as far as agriculture is concerned, because now they could have these enormous farms with very few people. You just go from the airplane, spray the glyphosate all over the crop. It doesn't die. I mean, it's very, very convenient. It kills all the weeds. The crop is fine because you have put this bacterial gene into the crop to protect it. It's kind of like Superman, you know? And that has a consequence of that is that glyphosate is all over our food. And it's not just the crops that are GMO Roundup ready, but also the many crops that are not resistant are sprayed with Roundup right before the harvest. And this is becoming an increasingly common practice because farmers are seeing that it's effective. You know, they get an increased yield. They get a head start on next year's weeds. They don't see a downside. They're spraying wheat, barley, sugarcane, all kinds of legumes, you know, like chickpeas and lentils and garbanzo beans. I mean, all these things, peanuts, they're all being sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest. And that glyphosate is really, really showing up in the food. We're finding that out from testing, you know, that's done in Canada, not the U.S. The U.S. is extremely reluctant to test glyphosate contamination in food. But Canada has tested a lot of foods, and they've seen huge levels, actually, in, for example, chickpeas. I mean, who would have guessed, you know?
I know. I heard you say that at this conference, and it was a room full of the naturopaths and functional medicine practitioners, and we all looked at each other because hummus is just one of those things that we prescribe as like this easy snack, and you could see the panic in everyone's eyes. So are our organic foods safe from glyphosate?
Not 100%. They're much lower generally, but not completely free. And in fact, what's really shocking, so Tony Mitra is a friend of mine. He's an activist in Canada. He's a wonderful man from India, very passionate about glyphosate. And he's the one who actually got Canada to go ahead and test a whole bunch of foods. And they gave him the results of those tests, which is really awesome. I mean, I have to say, Canada's responding a lot better than the U.S. is to activism, you know? 8,000 samples of various foods. He gave it to him in a very unprocessable format, so he had to go through a lot of agony, but he produced a book, an ebook, and you can get it on Amazon for very little money, detailed analysis of all the results of the testing of the Canadian government on foods from Canada, from the U.S., from Mexico, and from elsewhere around the world. So it's Canadian imports that they're looking at, and, you know, various food products. And one thing that was just really shocking to me is that I believe it was lentils from the U.S. and Canada, organic, had remarkably high levels of glyphosate in them. I just can't figure that out. Whether they're growing next door to a lentil farm where it's being sprayed right before the harvest and they're just getting drift, you know, spray drift, I don't know. But incredibly high. And the other thing is that U.S. and Canada had much higher levels in general of glyphosate in all their foods than any other country in the world, including Mexico. So he kind of groups U.S. and Canada as a sort of quote-unquote North America, leaving out Mexico. Mexico he puts in with the rest of the world because Mexico has much, much lower contamination levels in everything than U.S. and Canada. So those two countries are basically the big leaders in poisoning the food with glyphosate.
See, this is so shocking to me because even when I go through the grocery store and I'm selectively looking at things, there's certain countries I'm biased against because we make assumptions related to pesticide laws and organic products and all of these different things. So a question then, which I think is going to be an obvious question for people is, you know, you're saying that glyphosate is so dangerous. Why aren't the companies, or Monsanto in particular, who's producing this chemical, why don't they have any evidence around its safety?
They do. I mean, Monsanto has done a lot of studies. I work with Anthony Sampson, a wonderful man. He's a retired chemist, Arthur D. Little expert. He worked for many years in the lab in Arthur D. Little developing new chemicals. He's got lots of patents. I mean, he really knows chemistry. I've really enjoyed working with him. Interesting character, actually. He's obsessed with glyphosate, as am I. I mean, the two of us are, you know, like the Bobbsey twins. But we've published several papers together, and we are cracking this nut wide open. And he managed to harass the EPA sufficiently long. It took him years to finally get them to. They basically had to send off to Monsanto and say, if you don't object, we're going to give all this stuff to him. And if you don't say anything, we're going to do it. And then it timed out, and they did it. They gave him, like, you know, tens of thousands of pages of stuff from the Monsanto early studies of glyphosate, completely unsearchable. I mean, very tedious to go through it all, but he's determined, right? So he's just been pouring through this stuff, all these studies by Monsanto. And it's very clear to him that Monsanto knows. Monsanto claims, for example, that glyphosate doesn't accumulate in the body. And they know it's not true because they showed that it was showing up in all the different tissues, and highest concentrations were in the bone marrow, which is really scary because the bone marrow is where you have the new stem cells that become replace, you know, damaged tissue. They're the source of the immune system. They're the red blood cell renewal. I mean, really, really serious if you've got glyphosate accumulating in the bone marrow. And they knew that, but they buried it, you know. And then they also knew that low levels of glyphosate were more toxic in terms of carcinogenicity than higher levels. They saw that there was a nonlinear relationship. So they use a linear model, and with the linear model, they got, you know, non-statistical result. If you didn't use a linear model, you would get statistical significance. And they knew that too, probably, you know. He sees all these, you know, he has all this data where it's clear that glyphosate is carcinogenic. He's seen, you know, disruption of the pancreatic Achinar cells. I mean, he's seeing all kinds of evidence from Monsanto itself of glyphosate toxicity. Monsanto understood that this chemical is very unusual. The other thing they knew was that there was something weird going on with proteins. And this is extremely significant because Anthony and I have really zeroed in on what I think is the most important toxicity aspect of glyphosate, which is its ability to get into proteins by mistake in place of glycine. I think this is absolutely huge, and we haven't proven it yet. It's going to be proven because it's not that hard to do the experiments. It's just that nobody dares, or nobody can get the money to do it. You know, it will be phenomenal when a chemist proves beyond a doubt that glyphosate is getting into proteins by mistake and disrupting them, because that is absolutely huge if it's true. And if it's true, it explains all the correlations we're seeing between glyphosate usage on core crops and the rise in a huge list of nasty diseases, you know, diabetes, obesity, autism, Alzheimer's, pancreatic cancer, thyroid cancer, you know, gut disorder. I mean, all kinds of things, kidney failure, liver failure. All these things are correlated with glyphosate. And people scream at me, you know, correlation doesn't mean causation. I mean, but you start with correlation. And then when you can explain it by this mechanism of getting into the proteins by mistake, it's really pretty awesome. And we're just on fire with this. I mean, we really think we're right, but we haven't proven it yet. It will be proven in time. It's just a question of how long.
Well, and it's this classic North American thing that we do where we have this total lack of respect for this concept called the precautionary principle, which is when we start to see these correlations, rather than saying, oh my gosh, we should actually look at protecting everybody and we should just stop and we should investigate this further to keep people safe, we say, let's wait until there's a burden of proof that says they're in danger before we slow the ship.
I'm so totally frustrated with that. Yeah, because we see there's an exponential growth in autism, you know, and that is like really scary. That is going to be completely out of control in not that many years. And yet we say, well, you know, there's a perfect correlation with glyphosate and autism. But, you know, correlation doesn't mean causation, so we can ignore that. I mean, I don't understand how we can think that way. It's bizarre to me.
Well, and as we're having a greater understanding of the human genome and SNPs and these genetic differences that exist between us and these genetic vulnerabilities,
yes,
it's starting to elucidate. And that's one of those things when I'm talking to parents about autism and risks for autism or childhood leukemias or any of these different things, I'm always amazed at the lack of data that primary care providers are accumulating with respect to the exposure history of these kids or these families. Can you talk a little bit about the link that you think exists between autism and glyphosate?
It's huge. I mean, it just matches everything. I studied autism. I started, 10 years ago on this mission because I saw the exponential growth in autism. Numbers weren't that big at that time, but they were still scary. And I knew that exponential growth would really get out of control quickly once the numbers got big. I was frustrated that most of the money is going into genetics. You know, they're like, oh, it's a genetic problem. Genetics is not an exponential growth. You know, if there's exponential growth, there's toxicity in the environment somewhere. You've got to just find out what it is. I spent 5 years looking at everything, fluoride in the water and the plastics and the neonicotinoids and the vaccines, the aluminum and the mercury in the vaccines, the glutamate in the vaccines. I mean, all these different things. And I was frustrated. 5 years later, I was in a state where I understood a lot about autism. It's a very complex disorder, gut dysbiosis, sulfur metabolism problems, methylation pathway disruption, all kinds of things, various deficiencies and improper use of iron and just lots and lots of things. And the gut dysbiosis was really bugging me because I could see that was a key issue. And I was thinking maybe too many antibiotics, maybe they were sensitive to ear infections, they were getting too many antibiotics, it was killing the gut microbes. And then I happened to just be at a conference where Professor Don Huber was speaking, and he spoke for 2 hours on glyphosate. I walked into that room not knowing that word. And I walked out of that room a changed person. I mean, this was 4.5 years ago. And I stopped everything and started just learning everything I could about glyphosate because he filled the holes. I had all these things in autism that I couldn't explain. And he talked about glyphosate and explained all of them. I was like just completely blown away by his talk.
And when did glyphosate sort of hit the market? When did it start to be used in terms of mass crop production? And do we see a correlation in terms of all of these chronic diseases, including autism, increasing numbers around the same time?
Right. So glyphosate was approved in the mid-1970s. So it first really showed up on the market around 1975. And it wasn't used that much initially. It was used as an herbicide, but not so much. And it wasn't until they introduced the GMO Roundup-ready crops in the late 1990s that it really took off. From that point on, it was exponential growth. And part of the problem is that there were glyphosate-resistant weeds that showed up among the glyphosate-resistant crops. They hadn't, of course, anticipated that, even though they should have. They were saying that these crops were wonderful because they were going to reduce the use of herbicide, but actually they increased it. They grossly increased the use of glyphosate. Exponential growth year by year, starting around 2000. In the use of glyphosate, along with the exponential growth in autism. Perfect match. I mean, when you look at autism in first grade, according to the IDEA, which is, this compensation that you get for extra help in school, first grade diagnosis of autism in the American public school system, you look at that curve and you plot it against the total amount of glyphosate usage on core crops, corn and soy, over the previous 4 years, from the age of 2 to the age of 6 in that child's life. You plot those two curves, they coincide. They have a 0.997 correlation coefficient. It's a perfect match.
Wow. And so can you just really big picture for people, talk to us about how glyphosate impacts the body? Because, we could probably talk all night about autism, but, I'd love to segue that into understanding autoimmune conditions and talking about how you feel it's correlated with cholesterol and all of these other big picture things that are ravaging our healthcare systems and ruining people's lives, right?
Yeah, and what's happened is the researchers have really woken up on the problems of gut dysbiosis, and that's because glyphosate is causing it. We didn't realize, and we should have, that our gut microbes are so important to our health, and glyphosate messes them up. Antibiotics do too, and that's part of the problem as well. But glyphosate is a patented antimicrobial agent, and Don Huber showed in his talk that it disrupts the beneficial microbes more than the pathogens. So it leaves a vacuum by killing off the beneficials. And then the pathogens like Clostridium overgrow, and also G. sulfo vibrio, those things cause trouble in the gut. And they produce toxic metabolites that can directly lead to autism. So, for example, there was a paper very recent, I think 2017, maybe, I think it's 2017, triplets. Two of them had autism. Two boys had autism, and the girl had a seizure disorder. All three of them tested for high levels of glyphosate in their urine. And they had, and the paper suggested that it was overgrowth of Clostridium due to glyphosate. And the Clostridium produces a metabolite that prevents dopamine from being metabolized. And the dopamine then overexcited the neurons in the brain. This was a proposal they had for how it might be causing the autism. There's actually many, many different pathways by which glyphosate causes autism, as well as so many other problems. For example, celiac disease. Part of the thing is proteins. And I talked about glyphosate getting into proteins by mistake in place of glycine. This is absolutely huge. And this explains all these food allergies that we're seeing among children today: peanut allergy, egg allergy, milk allergy, soy allergy, you know, all these allergies. All of those foods can be expected to be contaminated with glyphosate. And the glyphosate can be expected to show up, if we're right about this, in the protein itself, the casein in the milk, the gluten in the wheat, right? All these proteins. And on top of that, glyphosate disrupts the digestive enzymes. It makes the proteins hard to break down, both because they contain glyphosate, but also because glyphosate disrupts the pancreatic digestive enzymes. Furthermore, glyphosate induces a leaky gut barrier, and I can explain how that happens, but I won't here because it's complicated biology. Produces the leaky gut, prevents from the breakdown of proteins. Those undigested proteins get into the general circulation, and this makes the immune system upset. The immune system reacts to those proteins by producing antibodies, and those antibodies can become autoantibodies through molecular mimicry. So because those peptide sequences in those proteins resemble peptide sequence in human proteins, certain, you know, particularly important human proteins, things related to thyroid, you know, function, the myelin sheath in the brain. I mean, really, you know, your body, your immune system starts attacking the human proteins. The collagen, which is all over the joints, you know, collagen is the most common protein in the body. It contains a huge amount of glycine. So it's going to get contaminated with glyphosate. It's going to become immunogenic. Antibodies are going to attack the collagen, and you're going to have joint, you know, shoulder problems, back problems, knee problems, all these different issues that we see today in chronic pain, where people are taking opioid drugs to try to relieve it and ending up with an opioid drug, dependency, right? These even to the point of killing themselves accidentally by taking too much. I mean, we have an epidemic in that right now. So there's like, all these proteins are getting disrupted by glyphosate. The immune system is reacting to them. And then the immune system is attacking our own proteins and causing autoimmune disease. Lupus, you know, multiple sclerosis, even Alzheimer's and autism, I think, are both, a component of them is an autoimmune attack on the myelin sheath because of this, through this molecular mimicry process.
Okay, so I have two. I have to have a timeout here for a moment because I'm overwhelmed with, I'm, you know, just thinking about patients and the chronic diseases that I have on a really practical level. Does glyphosate cross the placenta when women are pregnant? Okay.
Yes.
And so really what you're saying, because I want to pull it back and make sure, because I think people are listening, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed by how complicated this is, and I'm yes, overwhelmed by how pervasive this problem is, and so I'm just gonna shut it out, right? And so in essence what we're saying, because glyphosate has this capacity to basically mimic glycine, it's kind of like a Trojan horse.
Exactly.
And it's sneaking into the body in all sorts of pathways, sometimes seemingly separate pathways. And any time a pathway would use glycine to make a protein, glyphosate is sneaking in there instead, which is why we're seeing so many different types of diseases correlated with this one pervasive chemical.
Exactly. And that's one of the things Monsanto fights back with, is how could one chemical cause so many diseases? This is how.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of like giving a kid a can of spray paint and telling them to run through the house and then being like, oh, how could one kid and one can of spray paint completely destroy your home, right?
Yeah,
but
that's perfect.
Right. Yeah. I have three children, so I get that.
And it's stimulative too, which is what's also bad about it, because you don't get bowled over by it. You don't get like a big stomach upset or something. You don't notice you're being poisoned. That's really the insidious aspect of it. It just slowly accumulates until the point where it starts to cause trouble, you know, because enough of your proteins are destroyed that you start to get disease after a while. I mean, it's not like, it's harder to connect the dots because of that.
Well, and some of us are genetically more susceptible. So, you know, you combine family histories and you combine poor detoxification pathways or other exposures, and your cup may be more full than someone else's. And it's going to fill and it's going to overflow faster. And this is why when we start to treat individuals as opposed to, and I'm speaking to the choir here, but for people listening, this is why when we're talking about an individual and treating an individual, it's totally different than when we're talking about public health medicine and how we see things across an entire population.
Yes, and it's interesting when you look at all the autism, you know, genes. There's so many genes that are connected, you know, correlated with autism, a whole bunch of different genes that have a susceptibility increase. And it's really important to study those genes because that gives you a direct hint as to what glyphosate's doing. I take every one of those genes very seriously, and I look and I see, how could glyphosate disrupt this? And sure enough, I can find it, you know.
Right. Well, we're all different houses, so we're all going to weather the storm differently. And if your house is made out of twigs and your material isn't quite as strong, then you're probably not going to fare. You're not going to fare quite as well. But we just can't see what the material is on those houses until it's too late. Can we talk a little bit about the correlation between glyphosate and cholesterol and the relationship with sulfur? So you have two passions. It was really great as we were getting started here. You're like, I'm passionate about glyphosate and sulfur. And mm-hmm. I've never heard those two things combined in someone's passion before. Why is it? What's the relationship between the two of them?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because I started with cholesterol sulfate, and I figured that out early on when I started looking into autism. I thought cholesterol sulfate, that's it, you know, deficiency in cholesterol sulfate. I really believe that to this day. And then the question was, well, what's causing that deficiency? And also, how does the body produce cholesterol sulfate? You know, and one of the ways the body produces cholesterol sulfate is through sunlight exposure. And we're obsessed these days with sunscreen. We're using huge amounts of sunscreen, you know, much more, much higher level protection factors than we used to use. And so we're so afraid of skin cancer that we no longer get enough sun stimulation to produce the cholesterol sulfate that we need. And the red blood cells produce cholesterol sulfate in response to sunlight. And that is so crucial for their health. And the red blood cells' health is crucial for blood circulation. So you really get into a lot of trouble with the blood when you don't have enough cholesterol sulfate. And what's really bad is that the enzyme that produces the sulfate is affected very badly by both aluminum, which is in the sunscreen often. These high-end sunscreens have aluminum as an emulsifier to make them sort of easier to spread and not, you don't get that white paste. The aluminum is going to go into the skin. It's going to affect the ability to make, it's going to disrupt the ability to make sulfate in the skin. And the skin makes a huge amount of cholesterol sulfate and ships it up to the body. So you need the sunlight. You don't want the sunscreen. And yet we've been harassed with the idea that we need to be very careful about protecting from the sun. And now the interesting thing is the sun does become toxic in the context of glyphosate, because glyphosate disrupts the skin's natural protective mechanisms. So, you know, it could be correct that we need to protect because we don't no longer have natural protection. But where do you go with that? I mean, it's just like one chemical after another, you know?
Right. Well, we're kind of creating this problem for ourselves.
Yes.
No, I was going to say, do you hang out in the shade? Like, how do we, I've got little kids, so I'm always like, what's the balance between a little bit of sun? Is it a little bit of sun exposure and then hang out in the shade? Is that what you would do?
No, it's lots of sun exposure. I'm completely obsessed with sun exposure. I spend half my time in Kauai where there's lots of sunlight, and I spend a lot of my time outdoors. My husband and I only own convertible cars, and we put the top down every chance we get. I mean, I am really looking for sunlight exposure. And I'm very healthy. I'm 69 years old. I don't have any health issues. I don't take any drugs. I don't take any nutritional supplements either. I just eat a really healthy diet, 100% organic, lots of sulfur. You know, it works for me. No joint pain, no arthritis, nothing, no headaches.
Amazing. So how are you avoiding all this glyphosate?
I'm not. I mean, I'm getting poisoned by glyphosate, and that's the big worry that I have. I try my best to avoid it, but I can't, right? So I know I'm getting a certain amount. In fact, I feel it when I travel, you know, because I'm very careful at home. We always buy organic. We're very obsessed. We buy organic wine, organic spices, you know, everything. Everything's organic in our household.
And for people who can't afford to eat that way, are there ways of navigating it? And, you know, when I studied environmental medicine a long time ago, one of the things that we were always told about was washing fruits and vegetables in vinegar as a mm-hmm. way of being able to help at least break down some of that pesticide residue. Is there something we can
work.
Do in between?
It doesn't take glyphosate away at all. Glyphosate is embedded in the proteins in the food. You cannot wash it off.
Okay, so
you wash off the insecticides, which is a good thing. I'm not saying don't do it. It's a good idea, but you won't get rid of the glyphosate.
Right. And are there any crops that we know just are not exposed to glyphosate?
Well, that's the trick, right? And that's why I'm so interested in Tony Mitra's book, because I think you should sort of memorize it. I've been trying to form a mental image of which foods have more, right? And you have to remember wheat, barley. So anything with wheat, you know, bread, don't eat it if it's not organic. Which is huge. You know, you go to the restaurant, they give you the rolls, they look so delicious. I mean, it's very frustrating that you say, I can't eat this, you know? I'm always very careful when I order on the menu. Of course, you never see organic choice. I'm really looking forward to organic choice, which is going to come
right.
on the menu, right? Because you have like gluten-free choice. You know, these days you've got all these different obsessions with different kinds of diets, vegan choice and gluten-free choice, but you don't have organic choice usually. And we need that. We need to have that opportunity to order organic on the menu. But you can be careful to choose items that you know, because you've memorized it, are less likely to be contaminated with glyphosate. So, but it pretty much eliminates lots of things, because you've got the corn, the soy, all the sugars, right? Because you've got sugar cane is sprayed before the harvest. Sugar beets are GMO Roundup ready. And high fructose corn syrup is from GMO Roundup Ready corn. So the sugars are all contaminated. The oils, you know, you've got canola oil, soybean oil. Those come from GMO Roundup Ready crops. And those are the cheap vegetable oils, which are typically used. Often at the restaurant, you don't know what kind of oil they've been using. And then you've got, you know, all the wheat and the barley and then the legumes. I mean, I really enjoy Mediterranean food, and I really like hummus. So I'm like really frustrated now that I know I can't eat it anymore. Even organic, if it comes from the U.S., it's going to be highly contaminated with glyphosate. You sort of have to learn which foods to avoid and which foods are okay. So I think the vegetables and the fruits are probably safer.
And are there any countries that have banned glyphosate? Like, where should we be traveling?
Sri Lanka. And I have to say, I just returned from Belize. I had a lovely visit there. Belize is a tiny little country in Central America, right? And they have a lot of evidence of glyphosate poisoning going on right now, with increases in diabetes and obesity and all the obvious stuff. And I was able to really meet with their pesticide control board and get response. I mean, I was so impressed, because they were obviously concerned with what I had to say. I would love to see them take action. They haven't yet, but I feel like there's hope that the small countries are going to ban it first. Sri Lanka banned it because they found it very clear that glyphosate was the cause of an epidemic in kidney failure among young agricultural workers working in the fields where glyphosate was being used. So it was very clear that those workers over here where they use glyphosate, they've got the problem. Those workers over there in this other area where they don't use glyphosate, they don't have the problem. They figured it out, you know, and they banned it. I mean, it was just so beautiful that a small country can have that kind of power to just decide, you know, we're just not going to do it. U.S. is going to be, it'll be a miracle if we ever ban it, I think.
Well,
I've tried. We talked to the EPA. They were basically really uninterested in hearing what we had to say. I mean, it's frustrating with this country. We have got so much money pouring into the government from the chemical industry that the government is just at their service, and they don't care that our country's being destroyed by this chemical. They simply don't care. They don't want to believe it. You know, they just refuse to listen.
Can we test for glyphosate in our bodies?
Yes, you can send off a urine sample. It'll cost you maybe $100, $150, so it's not cheap. But it's possible to do it, and there are websites that support that. There's My Labs for Life, I think it's called. Anyway, I have the information not on the tip of my tongue.
That's okay. I'll get it from you and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. That's great because you can find out at least momentarily because, of course, it comes through. Most of it kind of washes through and shows up in your urine. So you're getting kind of when you're measuring your urine, you're getting your exposure mostly over the past 2 or 3 weeks. So it's a short-term measure. Whereas a certain percentage of it is going into your bones and you won't be able to see how much of that has already accumulated in your bones.
Can we get it out again?
That's really challenging, but there are some hints as to how to do it. And in fact, I think some studies on cows have been especially interesting to me because there was a lovely paper that was published recently on cows that they showed they had glyphosate in their urine, high levels, they were sick. And they fed these cows, and they probably knew this from experience, organic matter from the soil. So like fulvic acid, F-U-L-V-I-C, mm-hmm. and humic acid, which is sort of complex organic matter from the soil, which apparently binds to the glyphosate and takes it out through the feces. There's also bentonite clay, also from the soil, and activated charcoal, all those things. And then the really interesting thing is sauerkraut juice. They gave the cows sauerkraut juice. I mean, who would have thought of that, right?
They're naturopaths.
Yeah. Right. So probiotics is huge. And I really recommend that people eat probiotics, natural live fermented foods, sauerkraut, sour cream,
kombucha.
Kombucha is fantastic. Yes. And kimchi and yogurt, you know, all those things that are fermented foods. It's interesting because there's a particular microbe in sauerkraut juice and in also apple cider vinegar, acetobacter. And I think it might be in all of those. Also cheese, you know, like sort of brie, sort of strong cheeses.
You're speaking my language now.
Yeah.
we're moving into like the really happy part of the interview.
Yeah, I know. I love cheese. I can never get enough cheese. So acetobacter is a very common microbe in these various fermented foods. And it's very interesting because there's very few microbes that can actually metabolize glyphosate. And acetobacter is on that short list. It can actually take the glyphosate molecule apart and use the phosphorus that's in the glyphosate molecule as a source of phosphorus. It's quite remarkable because glyphosate has this unique CP bond that's very, very hard to break down. Only a few microbes can do it. And acetobacter is one of those. So I think when you eat fermented foods, first of all, you renew your gut, your healthy gut microbes. But secondly, you actually provide yourself with microbes that can metabolize glyphosate and clear it right away. So that's really, really super.
It's really kind of cool when we as humans get ourselves into predicaments, oil spills, glyphosate. It's the microbes that are coming to our rescue.
Yes. It's so really interesting.
It is. You know, the audience listening to this, these are innovators. These are intelligent people. These are people who are problem solvers in a variety of fields. And I also know it's a really passionate population. This is a monumental problem, not just for us in North America, but really the globe and food and ensuring that we have enough food for our populations and then ensuring that we have it available in a safe way is as big a problem as they come. Mm-hmm. With this group of people listening, what kind of solutions do you think we need to this problem? What kind of direction can we give them in terms of going back and giving them the task of helping us collectively find a solution to this very big problem?
Yeah, I think there's really two really important parts of fixing the food. One of them is fixing the soil. And the soil, of course, is suffering just the same way as the gut microbes are. The soil is a mess right now. Every year that you grow a GMO Roundup Ready crop and you supply glyphosate, the soil gets worse. It loses its organic matter, you know, because glyphosate basically kills the microbes in the soil just as it does the microbes in the gut. It prevents the nitrogen uptake. It actually prevents the uptake of nitrogen, sulfur, and carbon into organic matter. So it's causing a major factor, I suspect, in global climate change because the soil is not taking up nitrogen, carbon, and sulfur. And instead, those are getting released into the air. Nitrogen, for example, nitrogen oxides like nitrous oxide, you know, over 100 times as effective as a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. So you're causing a lot of issues with climate change as a consequence of wrecking the soil with glyphosate. So first of all, stop using the glyphosate, but then you have to figure out how to fix the soil. And of course, you know, compost, right? You've got to introduce microbes. You've got to do all the same things you would that you would do with the gut to fix the soil. And so you've got to develop research strategies that will repair the soil, get rid of the glyphosate in the soil to produce a healthy soil that can then be used to grow organic crops. Because one of the frustrations with the big farms is once they've been using glyphosate for years and years, it's not easy for them to convert to organic. You know, they have to wait several years before their soil is clean enough to pass inspection. So that's really a barrier for them. So we need to find efficient ways to fix the soil and then, of course, plant organic and then find efficient ways to control the weeds. And so there's some great research that's going on. There's a fellow named Ben Dobson. He was one of the people who went with me to the EPA to try to defend, to show them how toxic glyphosate was. And he's a fixer. And he actually grows corn and soy organically and economically. And he has, and his methods are so much better because he grows, he plants a cover crop in the winter. And the cover crop is going to help, again, to fix the soil, fix the climate change, you know, really do everything to reverse climate change. And furthermore, build this big, big fat crop over the soil that then becomes a barrier for the weeds. So he then has this masher that mashes down the cover crop. And then he has this machine that can puncture the seeds through the cover crop to get the corn seeds planted, and the corn comes up through the cover crop, and because the cover crop is mashed all over the soil, the weeds can't grow because they've been there's this mat mesh that keeps them from being able to grow. So he doesn't have to use any herbicides. He can just grow his corn, and he's got healthy soil. I mean, there's just nothing not to like about that.
It's amazing. These ideas will absolutely change the world. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. With spring in the air, we are focusing on detox and toxicity. Through the quiz, we're going to help you understand whether you possibly have exposures you didn't even think you were having, and how to tell whether or not your body is better or worse than the average person at being able to remove these things from your immediate environment. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to MeganWalker.com/Anthropology quiz. Dr. Seneff, I want to just segue a little bit. And you know, in closing this interview, I've got a series of questions that we ask everyone who comes on podcast, and I would love to get your perspective on them. Knowing your lens and understanding your passion, how would you define health?
I think health is certainly just feeling good and not being in pain and being able to just be positive and enthusiastic about the world. And I think it comes about because of healthy food, rich in micronutrients and a conscious effort to avoid toxic chemicals in the environment.
Amazing. I really like that. The second half of the interview, and this is a really quick half. It's basically like the last sixth of the interview, are what I call key performance indicators. So these are KPIs are those quick indicators that we would look at in a startup to assess the overall health of our venture. And I have a few that I really like to ask my guests. So if you'll bear with me for a few of these rapid fire questions, they're going to be a little bit different than some of the topics that we've been talking about. So the first one I have for you is, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share it?
I do. It's kind of fun, actually. I start off with, you know, my coffee. I go down and make my coffee. And then I usually work a killer Sudoku puzzle. I love challenging puzzles. That's what biology is all about. And I kind of fire up my brain by working a killer Sudoku puzzle first thing. And then I basically hit my email for a while. And then sometime in the early morning, well, maybe around 9 o'clock, I take a walk. And I am fortunate that I live near a vast woods. And I go into the woods and I have a different path. You know, I try to do a different path every day because it's got all these paths, lakes and whatnot. Walk maybe an hour through the woods, meditating, kind of, feeling nature, and come back and settle in. If I have breakfast, I often don't have breakfast beyond coffee, but I might have a few blueberries or a little bit of cheese.
There we go. Cheese again.
Yes.
Fiction or nonfiction? What are you reading right now?
Oh, wow. Oh, my. I'm reading lots and lots of papers. You know, I just read papers all the time. I love to find a paper about some that's intellectually challenging to me, about some aspect of biology that I don't yet quite understand. So I'm all over the map with that, about everything under the sun related to biology. So I'm reading papers.
Okay, so then a perfect segue. What do you do for fun or play?
Sudoku puzzle. I think that's about the only thing. Walking in the woods and Sudoku puzzles. I mean, that's pretty much it. I am playing with my grandchildren. I could say that. I have some wonderful grandchildren who live close by. So playing with them is a great relief from my work.
That's lovely. I know kids have this incredible capacity to pull in play and imagination when you least expect it. The last question for you, entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
Oh my, I don't think I can answer that question. I haven't thought about that at all. I think creativity is born in us, and that's a crucial aspect of entrepreneurship. I think the educational system may try to beat it out of us. So I think it's difficult to grow up in this country and still retain that creative bent that you need to be able to break away from the mold, right? To be able to think differently and to think outside the box and come up with new ideas. So I think creativity is an innate aspect of the human species, but it can be beaten out of us by society.
I thought you were going to say we're all entrepreneurs. It's just glyphosate interrupts it in some of us.
That is true, too.
You never know, right? No one's looked at it quite from that angle. This has been such an enlightening interview, and I can't thank you enough for your time and frankly, the work that you're doing on behalf of all of us. If people want to learn more about what you are doing and how they can get involved and how they could be involved in creating change with respect to this issue, where would you like me to direct them?
I think the first thing is if they can memorize my last name, Senneff, because that's a sufficiently unique name that if you type it into Google, you'll find a whole bunch of hits of various interviews like this one and various slide presentations and papers that I've written. I have a webpage at MIT, and it's sort of a complicated URL, but I will give it to you. http://people.csail, Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. .mit.edu/senneff. That website has a whole bunch of material, my various talks and papers and whatnot. So you can certainly find a lot of stuff there.
Leave it to MIT to make that a very complicated process for people.
I'll
make sure that we have that website in our show notes so that people can they can follow up with your work and that they can have access to some of your other interviews, because this is important information and it's complicated information. And so being able to access some of the really great videos and different things that you have done that break it down and make the science a little bit easier and more accessible for people, I think is really important for those who have an interest. Again, I can't thank you enough for being with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.